Not every worker went, however. Mr. Reed stayed on as superintendent of the old firm. Loyal to the end, he and Mrs. Reed stuck with the company that had made them. They faced a fiercely competitive situation, for Radium Dial now competed directly with Joseph Kelly's new business in the same small town. Just down the road from this battle of big business, however, Catherine Donoghue cared not a jot for the corporate infighting going on that fall. All that mattered to her was the tiny little girl she was cradling in her arms. She and Tom named their daughter Mary Jane, after Tom's mother. "We always called her Mary Jane," remarked her cousin. "Never Mary, just Mary Jane." Catherine Donoghue vowed that she would make her daughter proud. Chapter 45. As 1935 began, Jay Cook was busy working on the women's lawsuit. He filed two separate claims for them, one in the normal law courts and a second with the Illinois Industrial Commission, IIC. The lead case, Cook determined, would be that of Inez Valla. "She was a living corpse," Catherine said of her former deskmate, "hobbling around like an old woman." But, as the case got going, almost immediately the women ran into trouble. Radium Dial was being represented by a team of top lawyers who found several legal loopholes through which they twisted the case. There was that old chestnut, the statute of limitations. Inez had filed suit years after she left Radium Dial, and her disability did not occur while she was employed. There was the fact that radium was a poison. Injuries caused by poison were not covered by the Occupational Diseases Act. And there was the law itself. Radium Dial charged that its antiquated wording was vague, indefinite, and did not furnish an intelligible standard of conduct. "When Attorney Cook filed his test case," the Chicago Daily Times later wrote, "Radium Dial did not even bother to deny the women's charges. In effect, the company's reply was, 'Even if it is true, what of it?'" On 17th of April, 1935, a ruling was given. The court ruled that the legislature failed to establish any standards by which compliance with the law could be measured, reported the Ottawa Daily Times. The women had lost on a legal technicality. They could not believe it, yet they fought on. Cook, at his own expense, took the battle all the way to the Supreme Court. Yet it was all to no avail. The law was declared invalid. The Chicago Daily Times called it an almost unbelievable miscarriage of justice. But there was nothing the women could do. They'd had their day in court, and the law itself had been found wanting. "There was never a trial of this case on its merits," lamented the newspaper. Cook, reluctantly, had to drop their case, even though the girls still had a claim filed with the IIC, and legislators now vowed to rewrite the law in light of the women's case. "I hated to have to do it, but I simply couldn't afford to keep on," Cook later said. "If I had the money, I'd fight their case free. It's one of those things that should be fought through to a finish. I hope they get another lawyer." But finding another lawyer was easier said than done. There were 41 attorneys listed in the Ottawa Town Directory, but not one would help them. Just as the native physicians had done, the legal profession was shutting down what was seen as a scandalous attack on a loyal local business. As if to rub it in, on the day the Ottawa paper reported the loss of the women's case, it featured an article on Clarence Darrow, one of the nation's leading lawyers. That was the kind of person the girls needed, but they had no money to secure legal aid. The Donahues now found the mortgage on their house had crept to $1,500.